and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome to the Thursday morning show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. We are on Zoom today and experiencing some technical gremlins of an undetermined origin. So anyway, we apologize if the sound quality of this conversation is compromised. But nevertheless, we think it's going to be well worth your trouble to listen past all of that in order to enjoy the conversation that is about to unfold. First of all, this is Nan Roberts' monthly visit to the morning show. And with her, a special guest by the name of Brandon Porter, who is pursuing his doctoral studies in botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And a good friend of his was recently on the morning show, and I'm going to let Nan explain a little more about that connection and how it happens that Brandon is joining us today to talk about two of his great loves, mosses and also orchids. So, Nan, explain how this connection has been made with Brandon Porter for the morning show.
Well, we've had Kathleen Thompson on twice now to talk about lichens and fungi. And both of those conversations were so amazing and fascinating. And, you know, now is a good time to go out and look at moss. And I just had a feeling that Kathleen would know someone who is an expert in moss. And so, of course, she did. And that's why we have Brandon Porter on with us today.
Very good. So we're all making his acquaintance for the very first time. And Brandon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Thank you. Nice to have you with us. Ahead of us talking about mosses, let's first talk about Brandon Porter. Tell us a little about where you come from originally, and maybe woven into that story can be the story of how you first became interested in the green things around us, mosses and otherwise.
Yeah, well, so I, as you mentioned, I am currently a PhD candidate at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And although I study orchids, I kind of had a long history with plants before that. So I grew up in Florida, in North Florida, and my dad was an orchid grower, really got interested, especially in orchids when I was, you know, very young. But when I started at the University of Florida, I wasn't 100% sure exactly what I wanted to get into. I started out with microbiology. I just felt like I couldn't really grasp things that I couldn't see so easily around me. So started to rethink things, and I gravitated back towards what I knew, which was plants. And how I started with the mosses in that was really the first class that I took in plants at the University of Florida, a class called Plant Diversity. And it was taught by Dr. Stuart McDaniel, who studies mosses. And I was involved as a volunteer in his lab doing rearing of mosses, growing mosses in petri dishes, thinking a lot about the life cycle of mosses and some of the research that he does in the evolution of mosses and sex chromosomes in mosses. So I guess through that, I really started to think more deeply about mosses than I ever had before. Started to give some talks locally along with other grad students in the lab about mosses. And yeah, that's kind of how I got started with that. Although now, as I mentioned, I study orchids here in Wisconsin. I haven't given up on mosses at all. I think that's kind of like my 1A and 1B, I would say. And yeah, so orchids and mosses, but those are the two loves, I would say.
I think as you enter a field of study where it's something that most of us have only the most casual acquaintance with, it's probably full of surprises, but maybe for you, because you have the background that you did, it hasn't been so much a voyage of like one surprise after another, and maybe just a nice methodical study of something that you already knew something about. Is that a pretty good way to describe it?
Well, it's kind of hard to say because, you know, focusing on mosses specifically, a big theme with mosses that I've found is that the fact that they're very small and often overlooked has made the study of mosses kind of a bit of a niche topic, even among the wider scope of botany. So, you know, I think anybody out there who has tried to figure out what kind of moss they have growing in their backyard, they can probably attest to this too, that, you know, the resources out there can be very technical and kind of hard to find. So I would say that, you know, there's a steep learning curve, and I really had to navigate that learning curve. And, you know, there were a lot of surprising things, you do kind of have to go into it methodically. But now that I've done that, I think that it's really exciting for me to be able to kind of pinpoint a couple of the little interesting little tidbits about mosses within that, big sphere to share with other people. I really like to do that. And particularly with the focus on our regional mosses or some kind of interesting things about our local mosses, because it's really hard to get that kind of information, I think, for most people. So, yeah.
And it's interesting. This is now the third morning show in about 4 months or so in which I have to ask such basic questions as, so is a lichen a plant, or is a fungi a plant, or is a moss a plant? I do know this much. Mosses are plants, but my understanding is that they are a very different kind of plant from maybe most plants. I mean, there are some things that make them distinctive from the rest of the plant world. Explain what those distinctions are, or maybe what mosses also share in common in their various varieties.
Yeah, absolutely. So so that's true. Mosses are absolutely plants. For botanists, a lot of times we like to look at different groups of plants from an evolutionary perspective and talk about their relationships. So a moss is really a type of taxonomic rank. So it's kind of equivalent to the ferns or the flowering plants or the conifers. We would technically call these all different phyla or phylum, a phylum. So a moss is a phylum of plants. And, you know, if you look at the history of plants on Earth, mosses represent some of the earliest plants that colonized the land from the sea. So they do have some, maybe you could consider them vestiges, or they have some characteristics that we think are more calling back to that earliest history of plants hundreds of millions of years ago. So for one, unlike the other plants, they don't have true vessels to conduct water in their cells. This is one of the reasons why you most often think about mosses growing in really wet areas or on a moist log or something like that. They don't get to be the stature of a tree or a shrub or even most of the herbs that we have because they just can't conduct that water. So that's why one of the main things we say about mosses are that they're non-vascular plants. Again, to contrast them with ferns or conifers or flowering plants.
So when they lack that, are you saying, for among other things, that they lack what we call roots, or are there other things that they also lack in terms of being able to transmit water?
Yeah. So the interesting thing I think about mosses is that although they lack those vessels, and indeed they lack roots, they do have things that are very analogous to those structures that you find in other plants. And this is because of convergent evolution, which really means finding the same type of solution to the same type of problem. So the problem is, you know, how do you stay anchored, or how do you conduct water to where it needs to go into your body? So although they lack those structures, they have those analogous structures. You know, we call them hydroids. It's just a type of cell that moves water. They have something similar to a root, which we call a rhizoid. Really, it's more to just anchor it, because moss cells are so thin that they can just take water in from the cell, just from the environment. So they don't really need a root the same way as like a pine tree does to take it from the soil. They can just take water in from their environment.
Yeah. So it's partly that they're right in the water. So it's not like the water has to get to them. The water is right there. That's why that bit of moss is growing right there.
Yeah. Although, you know, another really fascinating thing about mosses to me, maybe something that I didn't expect before I really knew about them, was that they really challenge our idea of, you know, plants that really are requiring water, you know, growing near water. There's mosses growing in desert habitats, mosses that grow on very dry and exposed rocks. You can even think about a moss growing on the top of a tree in a forest, you know, on a vertical kind of axis. It's going to dry out pretty quickly. So really, they can get very dry and only watered very intermittently. So they have this really miraculous quality about them where they can take water up very quickly and then dry out to be bone dry, and then they can hydrate themselves again. So yeah, a lot of mosses do grow in very moist places, but you know, they're just as easily found in some of the driest places as well. I think that's a very cool thing about them personally.
I'm already starting to get an understanding of why you have found yourself drawn to this niche of botany. I mean, we've scarcely scratched the surface, and already mosses sound like very, very intriguing organisms. I can't remember if we've touched on this yet, but my understanding is that mosses are not only non-vascular, but they're also flowerless. That is, these are plants that don't have flowers. And I suppose that's maybe more common than we might think. And yet I think most of us have a very rough idea of what a flower is. And we tend to think of course, tulips and daffodils and so on. And of course, the term flower can, I suppose, mean different things in different contexts and so on. But so is that something that mosses do not have? And if they don't have it, then what would be the analogous forms that would perform those functions that the typical flower performs?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the topic of plant reproduction and what is a flower, you know, for people who maybe went through an intro botany course in college, you know, this might actually bring shudders to them because it can be a really complicated topic. Like I alluded to earlier, part of my job when I was an undergrad volunteering with a moss lab was rearing them through their entire life cycle. So I do feel like, thankfully, I do have a good intuition about that. So let me see if I can try to demystify it somewhat. So all plants, you know, from mosses, ferns, conifers to flowering plants, they all have the same basic life cycle, which we call an alternation of generations. And for us, you know, knowing about the life cycle of animals, it's a very different kind of thing going on. It's kind of like if you had two different bodies, two different individuals that or generations that you alternated between. And those two bodies are doing completely different things. One of them, you know, in the case of plants, is responsible for producing spores. And one of them is responsible for producing the gametes, which are egg and sperm. So all plants have that alternation, but how they go through it and what it looks like is a little bit different in each of the cases. So, you know, how it works in a flower is very different than how it looks in a moss or a fern. But just to kind of, you know, talk simply about it, a moss is made up of those two different parts. One of them is producing eggs and sperm, and one of them is producing spores. In a flower, this is all happening in the different parts of the flower. So the anther or the stigma and the ovary. And it's kind of like different parts are kind of like stacked on top of each other. It's very complicated. But in a moss, it looks a little bit more simple. If you go outside and you just look at some mosses in your backyard, you'll see the green part of the moss, the part that's leafy. That is the part of the moss that somewhere on it is responsible for producing egg or sperm. So that's one generation of moss. If you look a little bit closer, you might see a little structure that's coming off the top of the moss. It's not green. It's going to be probably brown, and it might have a little capsule at the end. That's the second generation of the moss. It's a totally different genetic organism than the green part. And that's the part that's producing spores. So, you know, some people in the past have called that like the flower of the moss, but it's really not the same thing as a flower. It's a little spore capsule. And each of those little spores that come out of there are going to go and land somewhere and make a new green part of the moss. So those are the two generations. Mosses, just, you know, to kind of conclude this, are unique in that spore producing part is really dependent on the green part of the moss. You know, again, these are two different complete individuals, but one of them is very dependent on the other. So that's another unique thing about the mosses, but that's kind of what's going on there.
I know that there are a couple of close cousins to mosses, and these are the kind of words that, you know, you've maybe looked at 15 years ago in a book or something and have otherwise never encountered. I mean, things like liverworts. I mean, I know I've seen that word, but I wouldn't have the slightest clue what that's referring to. But apparently that is something that's relatively close to the moss. Can you tell us about that and other close relatives to the moss? And do these other things that are not called mosses, do they kind of look like mosses? I mean, would we typically mistake them for mosses?
Yeah, okay, another great question. So there's a bit of an identity crisis when it comes to mosses, because a lot of things get called moss that are really not a moss at all. And then there's also some other things that we don't call moss that are actually very closely related to mosses. So I'll pick those apart a little bit. You know, down in the South, we have this thing called Spanish moss, which grows on trees. That's actually not a moss at all. That's a flowering plant that's related to bromeliads. So Spanish moss, not a moss. You might also see something that's called club moss or fir moss. These are actually not mosses either. They're a type of vascular plant that does not have flowers, which is called a lycopod or lycophyte. So club moss or any of those kind of things are not mosses either. And you might also hear about something called Irish moss. That's actually an algae, not a moss either. So a lot of things get called mosses, which kind of look like mosses, but really aren't. Then, as you mentioned, there are some other plants, and you know, these are different phyla of plants, just like I mentioned with the ferns or conifers. You know, it's a whole rank. One of those are the liverworts, and the other one are called the hornworts. And both of these, we think, are closely related to mosses. And some of the things that they share with the mosses is that kind of peculiar type of life cycle that I mentioned, where that spore-producing part is dependent on the gamete-producing part. So they share that. It's a little bit of a technical thing. They're also non-vascular. So those are the three groups of non-vascular plants. They do have a lot of diversity in their shapes, though. So most of the mosses that we see, you know, they are leafy. They look like they have leaves. There are some liverworts that also have what they look like leaves. They look very leafy. So those could be confused with the moss. But I think the liverworts that we're most familiar with, if you, you know, do know about liverworts, are the ones that are very flat and look like a ribbon. We call that a thallus or thalloid liverwort. You might see these, you know, if you've ever been around the Driftless area, they really like to grow on some of those rock walls in places like Parfrees Glen or the Kickapoo River Valley. So those are relatives of moss. It's in the moss world, and really in the plant world in general, it's still a very hot topic, very controversial, exactly how all of those are related to each other. There's a lot of differing opinions about that and differing research. So that's actually a very active area of research currently. But we call those three together, the mosses, the liverworts, and the hornworts. We call those the bryophytes. So if you see bryophyte, that's just another word for a non-vascular, non-flowering plant in one of those three groups.
For those of you just joining us, today is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show, and she has invited, and we're so glad she did, Brandon Corder, who is pursuing his doctorate in botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we are here talking about his primary area of interest and expertise, which is mosses. And a little bit later on, we're going to be spending a few minutes talking about orchids as well. Brandon Corder, so there is that sort of really typical moss that, if we've seen mosses, most of us have seen that kind that's kind of a dark green and, you know, on the floor of the forest or on rocks or whatever. But it sounds like there is a wider variety of mosses than most of us would ever realize. Give us some sense of kind of the scope of diversity that we are talking about, not with any of these relatives or things that we are mistakenly called mosses or have the name moss but are not mosses. I mean, actual mosses. Just how wide a range of diversity are we talking about?
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite things about mosses, is just how diverse they are. If you look across all of the groups of plants, mosses are second in the number of species to the flowering plants. Although it's not very close, you know, we think that there's like 300, 400,000 species of flowering plants. There's 10,000 species of moss, which is a lot, 10,000, mostly in the tropics. And one of the really surprising things about mosses is just how many species we have in Wisconsin. So a lot of times when I ask people, you know, how many species of moss do you think are in Wisconsin? Most people tell me, you know, maybe a few dozen. We actually have over 400 species of moss here in Wisconsin, native to Wisconsin, 415 species. And we actually have more species being added every year. So last year, Keir Wefferling, who's a associate or assistant professor of botany at UW Green Bay, and the curator at the herbarium up in Green Bay, actually discovered a new species for Wisconsin, a really beautiful moss that we call the tufted fen moss. I think this was in Oconto County. So new species added. We get new species added every year, basically. It takes, you know, a careful eye. So 415, 416 now species of moss. Just to contrast that with the vascular plants in Wisconsin, I think we have about 1,870 species of vascular plant native to Wisconsin, and another 800 or so vascular plant species that are non-native introduced. So I think if you calculate out the percentages, mosses make up, you know, a little bit under 10% of all mosses and their relatives make up a little bit under 10% of all the plant species in Wisconsin.
In terms of their dimensions, just kind of their sheer size, what is the range of difference between mosses? I mean, for instance, are they usually a relatively thin carpet? I mean, that kind of moss, or are we talking about some types of mosses that in which their dimensions are dramatically different from that?
Yeah. So a limiting factor for them is that they lack those water conducting vessels that I mentioned before. So because of that, they're never going to get that tall. However, in certain places like in Southeast Asia and in New Guinea, there's mosses that can get almost up to a foot high, individual moss plants up to almost a foot high. So the reason they can do that is, one, it's very moist in those places where they're growing, it's very wet, but also those particular species have some better developed tissues inside of their stems. So that lets them self-support themselves a little bit better. But, you know, besides that, for a moss that's maybe creeping along a log, you know, they can get a pretty big coverage over a long enough period of time. Also, mosses that are maybe either submerged and trailing in a river, you know, those can get to be maybe a foot long because they don't have to support themselves upright in the same way. They tend to grow rather slowly, but, you know, in a high enough quality site where they get enough time to grow, you know, you can definitely see some patches that are, you know, a few feet across. I also want to mention a really important moss, which is sphagnum moss or the peat mosses. Those are really important mosses. We can talk about those a little bit later maybe, but growing in a bog where the decomposition rate is very slow, they can get to be a few feet deep. Now, the further down you go, you know, they're no longer living. That's dead, partially decomposed material. But still, the thickness of the entire mat of sphagnum moss can be pretty significant over enough time, right? So yeah, it really varies. There's also some mosses that, you know, are way tinier than even your pinky nail. So they really have a wide range of sizes and shapes. It's really incredible, yeah.
How about color? Are mosses always green?
Yeah, another good question. So, you know, if anybody who's listening has been up to northern Wisconsin and walked around a peat bog, you know, you've probably seen a lot of sphagnum moss up there. And it's surprising to me that it's not only green colors, but also sometimes really strikingly red. And although I'm not 100% sure exactly what is responsible for that red color, we do know that those type of pigments are most often produced in high sunlight environments as kind of a way to protect the cells from the sun's light. So definitely sphagnum mosses can be bright red. Most of the mosses that you see in a forest are, you know, some shade of green, dark green, light green. There is one species I really like that's called the oil spill moss. It's called Platygerum repens. And, you know, it grows around here on fallen logs. That one has a really nice iridescent sheen to it, which is really pretty. I'm talking here about the green part of the moss, right? The part that's responsible for producing the gametes. But if you look at that little section that's making the spores, which we call the sporophyte or the spore capsule, that part can range anywhere from red to purple to yellow. There's a lot of colors on that particular part. So yeah, there is a lot of colors in mosses, something that's not often talked about, but yeah, something to look out for.
So here's the million-dollar question. What are mosses good for? I mean, besides making life interesting for you and others who study them, do mosses serve any kind of significant function in the natural world? I'm asking this especially on Nan's behalf because that's one of the themes of so many of Nan's conversations on the morning show is about the interconnectedness of everything, of all living things. Connections that we often miss. But are mosses something that to which we really have very little connection? I mean, do they have significant roles to play in the natural order of things?
Yeah. So uses of mosses, I would say there's, you know, three categories. One would be kind of the, you know, maybe admittedly mostly niche uses of mosses by humans. In everyday life. So, you know, I can talk a little bit about some of those uses. Then there's also the uses that mosses have by organisms, and then kind of the ecosystem level importance of mosses. So just to kind of run through a few of those, and, you know, we can talk about any of these a little bit more if you want to. Some of the just niche human uses of mosses, peat is burned during the malting stage of some Irish and Scotch whiskies to give kind of a peaty taste to it. It's been used for bandaging, for bedding. It's used a lot in horticulture. You know, anybody who gardens orchids or grows orchids maybe has used peat moss in that. Those are some of the kind of niche uses. As far as the interactions with other types of organisms out there. You know, mosses are really good at holding water and making nice little moist habitats. So you see them as really good, I guess, incubators for certain types of trees in the forest. There's this thing called a nurse log. So, you know, if you've gone up to our northern forests and seen hemlock trees growing in a little line, that usually means that those seedlings were established on a really mossy log, a nurse log. And after the log has decayed away, they've maintained their orientation on that kind of line. Lots of different organisms, mostly, you know, invertebrates or salamanders, things that, you know, are requiring moisture, live on mosses. People might be familiar with the moss bears or tardigrades, which are maybe the most famous example of that. You know, I just got back from a few day trip to the Smokies, and, you know, I enjoyed seeing all of the salamanders that really like to live on these mossy rocks or mossy logs, kind of in a really protected and moist area. Yeah. There's some examples of organisms that eat moss. I think lemmings are one example, definitely other invertebrates. So those are the uses of mosses by organisms. But then, you know, like maybe important to everybody or should be important to everybody are the greater ecosystem level importance of moss, and especially sphagnum mosses, which I just mentioned as peat. So the peatlands, which cover, I think I've seen 3% of the surface of the earth, hold more carbon in them than all of the forests combined. So I was looking up a couple weeks ago, the IUCN, you know, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, they estimate that that peatlands are the largest kind of sink or storage area for carbon of any terrestrial ecosystem. So really they're storing a lot of carbon, which, you know, could become a problem when they get burned off either for fuel or, you know, in various types of uses. So yeah, as a global carbon sink, peatlands are really important. And there's a lot of efforts in really peaty places like Canada or Scotland or Russia to try to restore peatlands, you know, in the light of climate change and, you know, this concern about carbon in the atmosphere and burning of fossil fuels and things like that. So I would say those are some of the things that come to mind immediately.
Wow. And that last one is of extraordinary importance, because obviously too much carbon is a very, very serious issue in all kinds of different ways. So
peatlands are also, you know, essentially non-renewable types of habitats. Although, you know, you can cultivate or grow peat, really the reason why those peatlands store so much carbon is because they take a really long time to grow because of some of these conditions that coming from the sphagnum. So sphagnum mosses, they release these acidic compounds into their substrate, which really decrease the microbial activity, which makes it very slow to decompose. They retain a lot of water. They have all these other compounds that they release. So those habitats that those peat mosses grow in, you know, it's really constructed by the moss. They're really the habitat manipulators there. And it really takes a long time for them to grow and accumulate to become a healthy peatland. So, you know, once it's gone, it takes a really long time for it to grow back. So, you know, it's something that's really important to a lot of folks around the world who are interested in carbon cycling and climate change and things like that.
So in other words, one of the things that we should think about, and maybe most of us have never thought about, is the preservation of such habitats, because at least in the natural order of things, Mother Nature takes a long, long, long time to replace something that we might very quickly and thoughtlessly destroy. On a more individual level, is it possible to cultivate and grow mosses, or if one has beautiful mosses on one's property, is it possible, and is there any reason to cultivate the moss that one finds on your own land?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have been so excited in the last few years to see mosses really come to, or come closer to the forefront in people's minds when they think about gardening and when they think about home terrariums or things like that. I think that they really have been starting to get more popular. So, you know, there are concerns with that. I mean, you know, for one, like anybody who's thinking about growing mosses should always be aware of how they're sourced and where they come from, you know, to make sure that they're ethically sourced, because they do take a really long time to grow. So, you know, I don't think anybody should go out and just start taking sheets of mosses from, you know, their natural areas, you know, around the state or something like that. But, you know, there are people that do sell mosses online. You want to look into it and make sure that they're getting it ethically, right? But that is becoming a something that you can actually buy online, which is pretty cool. So that's one thing. If you're lucky enough to have land that has really nice mosses growing there, you know, the one good thing is that, you know, as native plants, you know, if they're already there, then they're probably going to do just fine without any intervention. And you can just go and admire them. And, you know, mosses, they're so tenacious. It really, like, you don't really have to do that much with them. So, you know, that's if you're lucky enough to have them already. If you do try to grow them at home, you know, a couple things that you want to be thinking about would be, you know, not letting them dry out too much, making sure that they're well watered, and also thinking about where they grow. And this really goes for any plant. And, you know, I'm no horticulturist myself, but, you know, if you're growing a moss that's commonly found underneath a forest, then you don't want to put it growing in direct light on your windowsill or something, right? You want to be sensitive to the specific requirements that they have, which, you know, you can find that from whoever you purchase it from. Everybody should go look this up. These really beautiful Japanese moss gardens where they grow over, you know, decades, an entire mat of moss, kind of like a lawn. I don't know how feasible that is here in Wisconsin, in most places, unfortunately. But when I lived out in the Pacific Northwest, I did see that that was starting to become an alternative to grass lawns, having a moss lawn. Again, might be hard for our climate here, or might take a very long time to cultivate that, but something cool to think about. Yeah.
For people who have had their interest piqued in our conversation about mosses, are there particular resources you'd like to direct them to seek out even more information?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I had mentioned a little bit earlier, mosses have such a high learning curve to them. And I think that that's for a couple of reasons. So for one, they tend to be quite small. And although, you know, to a careful eye, you can see such a diversity in the shape of the leaves or the different structures on them and all the, you know, the way that they branch and stuff. There's so much diversity to them, but it really takes a careful observer and really, you know, having a magnifying glass is really, you know, a good investment if you're looking to learn more about mosses. But because of that, you know, it's really hard to find good field guides to learn mosses. And the guides that are out there, you know, none of them cover exactly, you know, Wisconsin, for example, or even really the Great Lakes region per se. There are a couple really good ones, though. So I'll shout out a few. One that I really like that's online and free is from the Ohio Moss and Lichen Association. There's a really great moss photographer and scientist out there. His name is Bob Clips. He takes really awesome photos. So if you go to the Ohio Moss and Lichen Association website, look for common mosses of Ohio. I know it's Ohio, but I promise you it's really similar to Wisconsin in a lot of ways. He has really great photos of all of their common mosses. If you're in the northern part of the state, there's another resource which has really incredible, beautiful photos of northern forest mosses or swamp mosses. It's called the Northern Forest Atlas. It's put out by the Northern Forest Foundation, which I think is out of New York State. Go on that website, look up images. They have just the most amazing photos of mosses on there, as well as some resources that show some of the different habitats that mosses grow in. I'll shout out another one that I really like. There is a field guide to, I believe, mosses of the Appalachians and the Northeast. Now, it's kind of far from Wisconsin, but it still has pretty good overlap just because a lot of mosses tend to have a wide range. I believe that one is by McKnight. And you can find that one either at the library or online for under $25. It's really good for describing mosses, but you know the pictures are a little bit small, so it could be a little bit tough, but it does have a kind of a key that you can use to identify. Another one that's similar is, I think, Mosses of the Northeast by Pope. And same price, also online, a little bit better pictures. Those are four that come to mind, both in book and online. Yeah.
And Nan Calvert is planning to put a link on the Go Native page of the website for Root Pike Win, which is, of course, the organization for which she works. And so if people want to take down any of the information that you were just sharing, she's planning to share these resources and others again on the Go Native page of the website for Root Pike Win. Brandon,
mention one last thing.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I just want to give one more shout out to something. Some folks might be familiar with this already. iNaturalist.org. It's a website where it's kind of like a social media site almost for organisms. If you make an account on there, you can upload photos that you take of any type of organism, and it can be identified either by experts in the community or by their kind of their their machine learning or artificial intelligence algorithm. It's still learning with mosses, but you know, I mentioned that there's over 400 species of mosses in Wisconsin. Just through the efforts of people in the community, Wisconsin now on that website has one of the highest totals of mosses uploaded. I think 178 species, which is really incredible. You know, taking a picture of a moss can be a little bit difficult. You know, you really want to get in there and try to get a clear photo of the leaves. There's these little attachments you can get on your phone that that are kind of like a little macro lens, which can make it a lot easier. But I would encourage everybody out there to, you know, think about going on iNaturalist, upload pictures of mosses you see in your backyard. And, you know, you might find something cool or new, or, you know, it's just a really great way to learn about mosses near you. So iNaturalist, really got to shout that out. I really love that site. Thanks.
We have just very little time left, just a minute or so, to just give us a sense of what you are studying in your doctoral work right now in terms of mosses, any particular aspect of them?
Yeah, so my research is mostly on orchids. When it comes to mosses, it's really working with the herbarium to catalog mosses around Wisconsin and just talk about mosses with groups in the community. What I study myself is, if I had to sum it down to one thing, it's really, what do orchids eat? And it turns out that that question is very interesting because orchids tend to eat fungi, weirdly. So I'd love to talk about that more sometime in the future with you guys, but just know that if nothing else, orchids are really bad dinner guests. They are they exploit fungi, they trick pollinators, you know, they're really nuts.
So, yeah. A nasty, if lovely member of the plant world. And yeah, I think we very much want to have you back, Brandon, to talk about the intriguing world of orchids and their wide variety and, of course, their exceptional beauty. And as you said, some of the things that also make them, at least in some respects, slightly disagreeable organism. So we'll have to leave that for another time. In the meantime, I'm so grateful to you, and I know Nan is as well, that you've made time in your schedule to join us for this conversation about the fascinating world of mosses. Brandon Corder, who is pursuing his doctoral degree in botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. This was really interesting.
Thank you. I had a great time.
And Nan Calvert, thank you for this marvelous idea. And we look forward to having you with us sometime in June. Very good. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to speak once again with Trevor Young, who is the transit manager for the city of Racine. We'll be getting an update from him on the exciting process by which at least some of the public bus fleet in Racine are being converted to electric vehicles. Also tomorrow, a conversation with a very, very talented musician from Kenosha by the name of Brian Schottler, who is going to be playing a very special organ recital Saturday evening at the Chapel of Kemper Center as part of Kemper Center's 150th anniversary celebration. This is a fundraiser for an effort that is currently underway to convert some of the former dormitory space at Kemper into a museum space. And so we'll talk with Brian Schottler tomorrow about what he plans to play Saturday evening. And by the way, on Saturday in the podcast version of The Morning Show, I'm sharing an interview with Dan Hampton about his book, The Flight, which chronicles
the dramatic 1927 transatlantic plane flight of Charles Lindbergh. Saturday will mark the 95th anniversary to the day of that monumental achievement.